Welcome to the Human Beat. I'm Roger Rucca. Geologist Tom Horning knows Oregon's north coast. He also knows tsunamis better than most, from a wave that washed up to his family's seaside home when Tom was a 10-year-old boy. Horning understands how to listen to the land, and he'll be kicking off a series of talks under that title at 6 p.m. on January 21st at the Seaside Library. We talked with him about that series, about earthquakes and tsunamis, and how we know what to expect here from the Cascadia subduction zone. But first, we asked Tom how he became a geologist.
Most immediately, it was to learn about the disposal of nuclear waste, because I was a nuclear engineering major at the university. And before that, I was interested in where things come from my chemistry. In high school, I had a great chemistry instructor, Leo Sales, and I always wondered where copper or lead or strontium or whatever came from and how you got it. And I think those ideas were somewhat set up by my grandfather, who introduced me to volcanoes and things like silver coins when I was little. And so when I wanted to learn about waste, I decided I should turn on a little of the geology program at OSU and see what they had to tell me. And walked into the mineralogy lab, and here they all are, everything that I ever wondered about right there out before me. And this was a case of working really hard in nuclear engineering or playing in geology. And there was that difference. So I figured that out real quick. I'm not going to be an engineer. I'm going to be a geologist.
Well, you experienced as a kid some effects of geology in this area, because you kind of went through a tsunami in Seaside, did you not?
That's correct. Yeah, the Great Alaska Earthquake of Good Friday, March 27th of 1964, sent a seismic sea wave down the west coast. It's pointed in our direction. And it resulted in a wave coming in about 11:35 in the evening on top of a high tide, so that we had an 8.5-foot wave come up the rivers in Seaside. And the family lived near the mouth of the river, kind of in the neighborhood where widows and orphans would live, you know. And the water came into the yard and swept the car away and the fences away and the dock away and the chicken coop and the rabbit hutch around the backyard and left a foot of sand. And water about 3 feet up against the side of the house, almost within an inch of entering the main floor of the house, and turned our property from a grassy yard into a beach overnight. And there was debris all over the place.
Was this something that anyone there had thought about or envisioned before it happened, or was it a complete surprise?
Oh, it was what we thought about, because we'd had evacuation warnings previously. There had been an earthquake in Chile in 1960 that sent a wave up the Nicanicum River, not very big, but this civil defense people had this in their plans. They never knew whether or not the wave was going to hit. They just knew there'd been an earthquake somewhere, and so they would use best judgment to decide whether or not to warn us about it.
Mm-hmm.
The warning did come through for Seaside, but it was at the very last minute that they finally decided to blow the siren to cause us to evacuate. By that time, the wave was already in the neighborhood, so no one really got out of town. Although there had been notices on television and probably on some of the other radio stations, because other people had evacuated. Mm-hmm. But the decision by the city to blow the siren was put off until they got an all-points bulletin from the sheriff's office in Crescent City, saying he thought it was a good idea to blow the sirens, and so they all did, but it was already too late in Seaside.
And that effect was from a relatively far away earthquake, and we're talking now about one that won't be far away when we talk about the Cascadia subduction zone.
That's right.
Tell us about that. Now, 20 years ago, we weren't hearing much about the Cascadia subduction zone, and now we're hearing a lot. How has that progressed and our knowledge progressed so that we're focused on that now?
Well, we knew that there was a subduction zone here when plate tectonic theory got pulled together in the late 60s. The evidence of tsunami inundation or subsidence of the land during a shaking of an earthquake wasn't really measured until about 1982 or 83.
Mm-hmm.
And then the most important discovery was by Brian Atwater up on the Copalis River in 1985, where he had a ghost forest of western red cedar trees that had been killed by a subsidence event two or three subduction zone earthquakes ago. So for 800 years, these trees have been standing dead out in the marsh. And if you dig them out, you can find their roots down there about 5 or 8 feet, entombed inside of all this material, all this sediment that was deposited around them. And underneath that sediment was a tsunami sand layer. So Brian's work coincided with Kurt Peterson's at Portland State and a few other researchers. And all the estuaries started having all of these large tsunami sand sheets migrating in from the ocean by heavy currents moving rather rapidly and at unknown depth, but enough to transport sand as much as a mile inland. Mm-hmm. So you know the water can go as much as a mile inland from the shoreline as it was in 1700, which isn't much different than it is now. Mm-hmm. So then everybody got in on the act, and researchers from all over got into it. And then to include the offshore, Chris Goldfinger at Oregon State, an old classmate of mine, as was Kurt, was doing turbidite studies. Now, turbidite is a package of sediment that's left on the seafloor after an undersea avalanche goes screaming across. A great example of one of these was in 1929 off the Great Banks off of New England, where a strange earthquake shook the land and it liquefied the seafloor, and all these glacial sediments that had been drowned by rising sea level slid off the continental shelf and went down across the Atlantic seafloor and knocked out all these cables going to Europe. You could hear the phones break as the 100-mile-an-hour currents roared through and destroyed the cables. Mm. Same thing happens here. They leave a characteristic package of gravel, sand, silt, and mud, and then another one every time one of these things lets loose. And they were able to correlate the sand layers and the little carbon microfossils above and below the sand layers to determine when they struck, and they correlate fairly closely with the subsidence events we have on land. So you had to have a big earthquake to knock the thing loose. You have a subsidence event from an earthquake dropping the land regionally, and you also have tsunami sand layers coming in. It all adds up, and it finally capped off, I think, when the earthquake of 1700 was discovered to have occurred on January 27th, I believe it was. Trying to remember the name of the researcher right now. Kenji Satake was his name. And he had found evidence of orphan tsunamis striking Japan in the month of January of 1700. Very detailed records. And so it all added up, and David Yamaguchi and Brian had worked on Long Island inside of Willapa Bay, and they had some cedar trees that had not been harvested yet from the old growth forests. And you could see where some had died, some had been injured by subsidence, but not enough to kill them, and others were still alive. They cored all the trees, they compared all the tree rings. They could say in the winter of 1699 to 1700 was the last great earthquake, because it dropped the forest enough to injure these trees, kill these, and not harm these. So it's all added up, and now it's irrefutable.
So the connection with Japan is at that time, the tsunami created by the earthquake here went across and hit Japan, and the Japanese kept very careful records of that,
which
we now can look at.
That's right.
Well, I want to circle back to earthquakes and tsunamis and how that affects us in the present day, but let me ask first. Now, you're going to be doing a talk on January 21st at the Seaside Library called Rising from the Sea. Is that all connected to the earthquake, or what is that talk going to be about?
Well, it's part of our series of the Listening to the Land, which is all about getting to know your place. Mm-hmm. And it's sponsored by the Watershed Council and by the North Coast Land Conservancy to help people appreciate the natural history of the region. Mm-hmm. So I'm leading off because habitat is what we're trying to conserve in the conservancy, because organisms, creatures, and plants are adapted to specific habitat. And if the habitat disappears, the organism is extirpated. It goes extinct. So to maintain and conserve and connect these things together, we look at it scientifically to ask, why is there habitat here? It has to do with geology, and it has to do with weather. Those things come together to make mossy wet spots, or harsh, dry, bald, high areas up on the mountains, or seashore or estuaries. They're all connected.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea is to talk about the history of the Oregon Coast Range. In a nutshell, it's risen from the ocean over the last 40 million years, and there's probably 10 or 15,000 feet of material that's been washed away. And the stuff that's remaining has resistant rocks that form high mountain peaks, and we have valleys where there are faults or where there are soft sedimentary rocks. And the story is one of marine sedimentation as the region goes through the subduction process, and that kind of shifts and packs things underneath the land as we know it, and it lifts it out of the ocean,
mm-hmm.
just like putting cards under a deck. And so as you raise the land and weathering takes it, tears it down, you create all this marvelous habitat. And so the idea is to go through time and talk about what do we know about each unique package of sedimentary rock or volcanic rock that tells the story of its time, and what does that mean in terms of the big picture? And the big picture is that it all used to be 10,000 feet under the ocean, and it's been lifted 10,000 feet out of the ocean, and erosion has reduced it to the mountain range that we know now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to take people on a tour of with some pretty pictures and some fancy diagrams that show how the whole thing comes together, and then later on in the series people will talk about their special issues and they'll all build on that habitat issue.
Yeah, and this is a series of talks. It's the third Wednesday of the month, starting January 21st.
Yes.
And you'll be doing the first one, and continues through May 20th, when Neil Main will be the speaker.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let me come back around to earthquakes again and tsunamis. Well, the most recent set of tsunami maps that have come out mm-hmm. show quite a bit more inundation than the previous set did.
Mm-hmm.
And how did that come about? How did that belief come about?
Well, it's okay. It's easy enough to model a tsunami rolling up the bay and up the rivers or across the coast, but we don't know how big the waves are. You know, you haven't, up till this point, we've made assumptions about small, medium, large, and hope that we're right. But when the Cannon Beach was seeking to relocate their school, they wanted to know where to put it, and they didn't want to put it too far down in elevation just
right.
in case a wave would get them. So they hired the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries to do tsunami modeling. And as they went through the modeling, they basically bumped up against the inevitable question of how do you know how big the wave is?
Mm-hmm.
So they decided, let's analyze the things that we understand about tsunami wave generation and vary them all. There's like varying 10 major variables to 10 degrees of from minor to extreme. It's called kind of a Monte Carlo spread method. And they all result in various wave heights and wave breadths that when you plot them all out, you kind of find there's a sweet spot where most of them occur. And there's a few outliers that are extremely high and a few that are extremely low. And the extremely high ones are pretty close to what we know from field evidence about waves getting to 35 or 45 feet high based on whether they can leave sediment up on a 40-foot terrace or not,
mm-hmm.
or whether it goes back into the valley a mile or a mile and a half. But the extreme case resulted in waves that might be 70 or 80 feet high. But that's really improbable.
Mm-hmm.
So they chose to simplify it into saying it's like buying T-shirts. Small, medium, large, and extra large, and extra, extra large. Most likely we're going to have a large to an extra large tsunami.
Mm-hmm.
But just as we might have a very small tsunami, or we might have that extreme one too. No one knows for sure because we don't have any, the records aren't good enough here in the coast to really resolve that question. We do know that from what we know from field studies, which should continue to be done, is that the waves are about 40, 45 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So when you see those maps, you'll see the extreme case colored in as well. And if you want to use that as a guidance for where to go evacuate, go ahead and do so. Or if you want to make a decision about where to put your police station or fire station or hospital, do it advisedly because it may not be so bad. The Japanese had learned from this last earthquake in 2011 that they did have bigger earthquakes and tsunamis than they had expected. And in retrospect, they were fooling themselves because, for example, they built flood walls to prevent tsunamis from coming over the out of the bay and into the middle of town, the wave went right over the top of it. Mm-hmm. They just didn't make the wall high enough. They didn't think it would go over it. But in some of these communities, they had stones on the hills, big markers with words chiseled in them from the year 861. So, you know, like about the time of Charlemagne, that says, don't build anything below this boulder, because this is how high the wave came. And it was 40 feet higher than what they experienced in 2011. So they already should have known. They knew about those boulders. They just, no one ever connected history with science, apparently, and that didn't make it into policy. But when you get into it, you look at the economics of developing near the waterfront versus parking everything half a mile away up at 100 feet above sea level.
Right.
Well, economics wins out because it's always a short-term issue. So the question is, how do you want to live your life? How do you want to plan your community? It's up to each community to decide. Some, I think, can get away with saying, oh, we can go on the assumption that it's a smaller wave because, for example, the city of Newport, everybody can evacuate to safety before the wave comes in, and most of the town is actually above any tsunami run-up possible. So you can afford to be wrong. A town like Seaside is just the opposite. Virtually all of Seaside is going to get swamped even by the smallest wave, and it's going to destroy 98% of the houses and 90% of the businesses. And so whether it's the small, medium, or large, it doesn't make any difference. You should plan for the worst case. You can't afford to be wrong, because being wrong and not getting your people to safety in time means a lot of people die. So you want to obviously make civil preparedness or emergency preparedness your highest priority. And it should be probably an emergency type of priority, in my opinion.
I think it behooves all of us to get a hold of those maps and kind of become familiar as we can with them, because you know, we may think, well, I don't live in a place that's as susceptible, but you don't know where you're going to be when this happens.
That's right.
You may be in Seaside or Cannon Beach. You know, we all move around the coast, or you may be on the peninsula, which obviously has problems of its own, the very low-lying Washington Peninsula.
That they do.
Is most of the peninsula likely to be overrun with water, or how does that look?
It looks like it, yeah. There are a few places, particularly in the northern third of the peninsula, where there are some fairly large sand dunes that people could go to. But lots of it are so darn low, the water will go all the way across. In fact, some of the work Kurt Peterson did found just the smallest evidence of tsunami deposits back in the Cranberry Bog area in the middle of the peninsula, where all the sand had apparently been dropped out already before the water got there. But if it weren't for these little mica flakes, which flutter their way slowly down out of the water, and he just found those just embedded in between the layers of peat out there, he wouldn't have had the proof that he has that shows that the peninsula is indeed flooded. Mm-hmm. So one of the good things they're doing is they're planning on making the equivalent of small hills of sand, like 30 feet high or something like that, that are armored on the sides with concrete so that it won't wash away when the water goes around it and people can go run up to this artificial
hill. So there'll be some refuges then for people.
That's my understanding, yeah.
So I guess, you know, the first hope we ought to have would be that this doesn't happen for hundreds of years until we get smart enough to really be prepared for it. But meanwhile, you know, we need to know what these maps say and where the safe spots might be.
Well, I think that I wouldn't be too quick to say in the meantime we can just worry about that. Frankly, the statistics, when you parse them right, suggest that an earthquake may be imminent. The average for the last 10,000 years has been one earthquake every 500 years. But in reality, they can strike in as little as 150 years or wait as long as over 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. And if you look at them the right way, this is, okay, I'm putting on blinders now, any earthquake that takes longer than 500 years seems to provide a break in the history of earthquakes that identifies clusters of quakes. So within clusters, it appears there's been four or five clusters since 10,000 years ago. And two out of the five clusters have had recurrence histories within the clusters of about 300 to 330 years. The other three have had averages of more like 450 years. So somewhere in there, the next earthquake is likely to strike on the average anytime from now for out to 150 years from now.
Right, because we're past the 300-year mark since
right.
the last one.
It's been 314 years since the last one, 315 this January. So the average of our cluster is 330 years. That means in 15 years, if you just looked simply at the clustering average, the next earthquake is going to hit. In terms of clusters, I think something like 4 or 5 earthquakes out of the last 20 would have struck already in the time since our last one, in the last 314 years. There would have been 6 earthquakes. And then the other 14 earthquakes will occur in the next 180 years.
Mm-hmm.
Except, and then there's the 3 outliers that separate the clusters from each other, the weird long 800 to 1,000-year gaps. The funny thing is we've had 4 earthquakes in our present cluster, and the longest cluster is 5 earthquakes. Mm-hmm. So the odds are about 50-50 we're in the great silent gap, the next 1,000 years, you know, nothing will happen, or we're near the end of a cluster that has a habit of recurring rather rapidly,
mm-hmm.
and you don't know what the answer is. So do you want to play the odds? And which way do you want to play?
Yeah. Well, we've been talking about the Cascadia subduction zone, but that's not the only fault here, right? Aren't there other faults underlying our area?
Yeah, there are. The subduction zone is a massive fault that ramps down at a gentle angle under the Cascades. Goes down at about 12 to 15 degrees. Technically, it's 17 miles under Astoria.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the same distance over to Seaside. The overlying tectonic plate is the North American plate, and it's loaded with faults, crustal faults.
Mm-hmm.
And there's 2 that run right past Astoria. One's on the southeast side, and researchers from the USGS have done work out in the river over by Tongue Point, and using seismic sounding equipment, they've determined that a lot of the sand and muck inside of the river has actually overturned and made these big pillow-like billowing structures. It's a liquefaction feature caused by shaking from earthquakes.
Mm-hmm.
Could be the big subduction zone earthquake causes that, but it's also possible that that fault that runs right underneath Fern Hill and comes out there may have done the shaking that caused that liquefaction. But there's an even bigger one that runs underneath the Columbia River. You ever wonder why the Columbia is where it is? There's a fault under the river,
mm-hmm.
and it runs from northeast to southwest and goes right underneath the mouth of the Skipanon River.
So what does this say about that LNG terminal that's proposed for Warrenton?
It is the worst place to put an LNG terminal in this county. And it makes sense from the financial side,
mm-hmm.
because it's right there and it's available. But when you have a fault and 380 feet of valley-filling sediment that's filled the Columbia River in the last 10,000 years, that's prone to sort of behaving like jello in an earthquake and shaking amplification, it's going to really test the limits of engineering. Now, I should disclose at least a little. I worked for the county reviewing the LNG pipeline a few years ago.
Yeah.
And I commented on this LNG plant site as well. Had to withdraw my comments. It was apparently not in my job description, but they didn't make that clear. In any case, the faults have a way of, when a subduction zone earthquake breaks, it releases so much strain into the crust on both sides of the fault that a lot of little faults will break, mm-hmm. snapping and popping and blasting, and it could let loose a magnitude 6 earthquake right underneath the LNG site. Mm-hmm. Or seismic energy could get on that fault and ricochet up, as it was shown to do in Seattle back in 2001 when the Nisqually earthquake struck. There's a fault that runs hill and dale through the urbanized part of Seattle. And if you were within 200 feet or 150 feet of that fault, your chimney would break and fall off the side of the house. But if you were further away, no problems, because that seismic energy ricochets and refracts and bounces up that structure. So when you build a plant right on top of a similar structure, you know, this gooey, gelatinous material that's going to shake pretty hard, you'd better have good engineering solutions to fix it. And I got to say, they propose driving pilings as much as 250 feet deep into all of this stuff to hold and unify it together, but that's more designed for horizontal accelerations, so the slab could shift north and south or east and west. But a lot of times there's ground waves that roll 6 feet during this kind of stuff, and I'm not so sure that their designs can handle that. And a lot of engineering advances by failure, and it'd be a really bad thing to have fail an urban area like Warrenton.
Right. Well, not too long ago, well, I guess it has been some years ago now, in San Francisco, we saw some evidence of liquefaction and amplification in the Marina District.
That's right.
When it wasn't a very strong earthquake, and most of the city was fine, but the Marina District suffered tremendous damage.
That's right.
Because it was built on fill and sediment.
Yeah, that's right.
And so that's kind of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, yeah. They have researched this quite a bit and have the FERC manual, which is kind of like the Bible for how to design and build these things, attempts to address it. But you can also go to Japan in 2011 and see a bunch of petroleum refineries on fire.
Exactly, yeah.
So, you know, and they have the same kind of building code. So
The video from Japan, I think, was probably the most vivid lesson we could have about you know, what we can expect at worst and what we need to be prepared for.
Yeah. Yeah, if they want to build an LNG plant, I'm kind of sympathetic to the idea of moving fuels around, carbon pollution notwithstanding, but they shouldn't be putting it on the softest, worst place available. They should be putting it on the firmest, strongest place available, and that's not here.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they have to go further up the river to find the kind of site location that works best for them in terms of safety.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it's a very good place. All the other geologists that I talk to in the state all have ventured their opinions about this, and they're like that. They say, you got to be kidding me. What a terrible place to put something. I know that people can cite the FERC manual and say they've complied with its recommendations and therefore it must be right, but I think the FERC manual is going to be found to be flawed when this next earthquake strikes. It's going to be bad enough from shaking and damage from that, and then from broken pipelines up in the mountains and fires breaking out and things shutting down, and then the tsunami is going to go roaring through the plant or around the plant pretty badly as well. I don't know how well that thing would stand it.
Well, the pipelines are a whole other issue because there has to be a pipeline to carry the gas to the plant.
That's right.
And those pipelines will be subject to earthquakes as well.
Yeah, there'll be they cross faults, and some of the faults will probably reactivate. The question is, will they design them in such a way that they're flexible and can handle that? What will they do when half the mountainside slides because It's a landslide that's triggered only by earthquakes? The coast range is festooned with these enormous landslides that are so big we didn't used to see them. And it's only with back to the LIDAR, where you can actually see these slides are 3 or 4 miles across, that if you run a pipeline into it, across it, it's going to be pulled apart or stretched considerably. And I'm sure there'll be failures. I'm not sure it can be avoided.
Well, Tom Horning, thank you very much, and thank you for making geology sort of accessible to us who are not geologists.
Yeah, my pleasure.
You've been listening to The Human Beat with geologist Tom Horning of Seaside. I'm Roger Rocca. Thanks for joining us.